Okay. Today we're going to talk about the Philistines and also clean up a couple of things about the judges. One of the things as we went through the accounts of the different judges I wanted you to be aware of was where they came from and is that in focus? First of all, from which tribe did God raise up Ehud? Yes. All right. Okay, and what enemy did he fight? Okay. And it's not surprising that he was from Benjamin because it was Benjamin and to a degree Ephraim that were being afflicted by the Moabites. And so God chose somebody from the afflicted area. Deborah, it was from which tribe? Or I should say Dvorah. Sophie? Yes, so from the tribe of Ephraim. And although Ephraim was not suffering from the particular oppression, which was what oppressor this occasion? The Canaanite League in the north, headed by Hazor, we'll consider why God used her, because the actual military man, from which tribe did he come from? Barak, from which tribe did he come? Nope. He came from Kadesh-Dash. The name of the town he came from tells you what tribe he's from. It was Kadesh-Dash, and the other part of the city name gives you the tribe. Kadesh-Naphtali. It was a Naphtalite. Okay? Gideon, and of course Naphtali was one of those tribes up in the north that was being heavily afflicted by the oppressor. Gideon came from the tribe of Manasseh, and his tribe, of course, was one of those that was being afflicted by the oppressor in his day, which was the Midianites. So, again, you see, there's a logical reason why God raises up a judge from different tribes. He's picking somebody from a tribe which is being afflicted. And Jephthah was from Manasseh across the Jordan, specifically the clan of Gilead. He was of the offspring of Gilead. And again, remember when we read in Judges chapter 10, it was the princes and elders of Gilead who were suffering the affliction and were trying to find somebody to be their military deliverer, indeed going about advertising for one. Now let's consider their social status. From what social stratum does Ehud come? The skipping of Nile came from Judah simply because we don't have enough information except to presume high-born in the case of Othniel because he was related to Caleb, but that's a bit speculative. Ehud, we have more to go on. Yes. Right. Deborah? From what level of society? Again, the Bible gives us a very clear indication of what level of society she was in. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Why don't you turn there in chapter 4 for thyself? In verse 4 we read, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidot, she judged Israel at that time. She dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel and Mount Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. You see, she's not a prince of the tribe, but she is an established figure. She is a recognized leader of the people because she is recognized as an instrument that God is working through and is an established judge, even before she gets involved in the process of deliverance. So she is also up a crust, at least as the people that day would have interpreted it. Then we come down to the case of Gideon. And from what stratum of society do we see God plucking him, Mr. Nasser? Least clan in Manasseh. So he is a social nobody. And yet God chooses him. And then we have Jephthah, and from what stratum of society does he come from? Mr. Moeller? So obviously not exactly high-born. His father might have been prominent, but he certainly was not. So again, we've got a social, a very person from the lower stratum of society, a social outcast. He was even rejected by his own people and made to dwell in a foreign area. And so we have in these an interesting illustration of the fact that as far as God is concerned, the servants he chooses to use in major ways, he doesn't particularly care one way or the other about social status at the time he chooses to call them and use them. And I think we've seen that illustrated at other periods of history too. The God chooses people according to his own criteria, not the way men would assign status to individuals. Now, in each case also, what is it that made these people successful, enabled them to do the job they were commissioned to do? Was it Jephthah's vast military experience that was the key? Was it Gideon's superior bravery? Was it Deborah's innate qualities? And was it Ehud's bravery and ingenuity, etc.? What was the critical ingredient in each of the cases? Exactly. And also the fact that we see in almost every case, and we could presume it in every case, even though the Bible doesn't specifically mention it every time, but the pattern seems to be established, that God gave a portion of his spirit to each of the people he selected. You look at Othniel and his calling, it says that Othniel delivered Israel, but then it says, shows that God, through his spirit, helped Othniel to do that. And that it talks about the spirit of God coming upon Jephthah before he went into battle. It speaks about the spirit of God coming upon Gideon before he went into battle. And Deborah, of course, was using Barak as the instrument and telling him that God had selected him and God would go with him, but that wasn't enough for Barak. He wanted the physical presence of Deborah. His faith was weak at that time, even as Gideon asked for proof of God actually choosing him. It's not a period where faith was a strong commodity. So the critical ingredient was God's spirit. It didn't make a difference. Sure, some of these men had talents and abilities, but they all needed God's Spirit in order to use those talents and abilities most fully. So here we have a slide summarizing, as I say, their social origins and seeing that these were immaterial to God and choosing whom he would work through. And sometimes we have to learn that lesson ourselves. You know, we're brought up in the world to automatically give more respect to people that are respectable already, and we tend to weigh people even after we come into God's church by those standards. And we have to recognize that if God is clearly working through an individual, it doesn't matter what he was before he received his calling. It matters the fact that God chose to call him. In the same way as these judges. That it didn't matter really whether they were high-born or not. God chose to call them and use them and give them this particular commission. And that's all that counted. Now, we do not consider Samson along with the other judges because Samson's particular oppression that he was responsible for relieving is the Philistine oppression, which began at the same time as Jephthah's problem with the Ammonites. Before we get into Samson, I want to cover one thing we left hanging about Jephthah, and that was the matter of the fact that the people of Gilead, the leaders, had advertised for a military man to relieve them of their oppression. And we find this in Judges chapter 10, at the end of the chapter. People and the princes of Gilead said one to another, "What man is he that will begin to fight against the children of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." Now, what is it they offered Jephthah when nobody answered their advertisement, and they knew Jephthah was up there in the land of Tob, and they knew that he was an experienced military man? They went and asked him to serve them. What is it they offered him? Who found the offer? Paul? Yes, in verse 6 he said, "They said to Jephthah, 'Come, be our captain, that we may fight with the children of Ammon.'" Now, is there any significance at all in the difference in words between the head that was promised, the position of headship, which was promised to whoever would fight the Ammonites, and this position of captain, which was offered to Jephthah? Well, one illustration in the text itself shows us there is a distinction.
where do you find evidence in the text that there is a distinction, that they're not just synonyms for the same office? Many of you forgot to do this because you're excited about Educational Field Day. Bill Lingy. Right. In other words, there are two different offices. The head is one office, the captain is another office, and he filled both of them. Notice as we read the account, beginning in verse 6, they said to Jephthah, "Come and be our captain, that we may fight against the children of Ammon." And Jephthah said to the elders, "Hey, wait a minute. You're coming to me that I should be your captain. Didn't you hate me and expel me out of my father's house? Didn't you run me out of town on a rail? So after treating me in this fashion, why are you coming to me now in your distress?" And the in other words, he wasn't taking their offer. The elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "Therefore we turn again to you now that you may go with us to fight against the children of Ammon." And now notice they changed their offer. They upped the ante. He didn't respond to the bait of the office of captain. So they up it to what they had previously advertised, and they say, "And be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." And so Jephthah says to the elders, "If you bring me home again to fight against the children of Ammon, and the Eternal deliver them before me," so he recognized what even he needed as an experienced military man, "will I really be your head? You really mean to go through with that?" And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, "The Eternal be witness between us if we don't do according to our word." In other words, there's an oath-taking here that let the Eternal punish us himself if we don't faithfully perform this promise. And so Jephthah agreed to go with them, and he became both head and captain. Now, what is the difference between these two offices? Well, first of all, which is the higher? This is obvious from the text itself. The headship is higher, because they probably didn't think it was needful to offer him that high position, because after all, he was just a social outcast. Maybe he'd come for the lower position. So when he didn't, they had to offer him the upper one. So the headship is up here, and the captain is here. Now, the Hebrew word for captain is nagid. I had to stop and think myself. Nagid. N-A-G-I-D. N is in Nancy, A-G-I-D. We transliterate it. Now, a nagid, it can be translated as captain, but it doesn't give you the flavor. The best translation is probably viceroy. Now, those of you from the Commonwealth or from Britain, one of you perhaps would like to explain to the class what a viceroy is, since you're more familiar with the usage of that term. Or should be, I guess. Roger? Yeah. Yeah. Not only representing the king, but there's another aspect of being a viceroy. Okay, the full authority and all the powers of the king or queen in that area. Now, in the modern Commonwealth system, Governor General would be the most applicable comparison, because in Australia or Canada, the Governor General exercises the powers of the Queen in those countries to dissolve Parliament, to grant pardons, etc., etc., you know, as those things go. This is what this term means. But in other words, it is not an independent authority. When he acts, he doesn't act on his own authority. He acts in the name of and by the authority of the higher-ranking individual. You see. And so Jephthah wasn't interested in this lower ranking position. He knew that they had offered the top job to whoever would solve their problem, and he wanted them to fulfill the promise to him as well. And so he occupied, you see, in essence, both offices. Now, this is the actual executive office. This is more the titular head. And this is the one who actually carries out the actual responsibility. You see, who actually carries out the responsibility. And so he was given both offices, both the titular headship and the job involving carrying out the specific responsibilities. And this is an important term, not only because it reveals something that's interesting about human nature, that here they need a man to save them. And so they advertised, you know, these respectable people of their community. If any of you respectable people, men, will take on the responsibility, we'll make you the titular head of our whole tribe. But no, none of those, quote, respectable people are anxious. And they're forced to go to this social outcast, and they say, we can't make that social outcast our titular head. I mean, that's disgusting, the idea. We'll offer him the dirty work job, the one that has to do all the work, but we'll keep somebody respectable over him. You see. And Jephthah didn't like that idea. He insisted on being treated like anybody else. So there's a little bit of an interesting interplay of human nature here involved in the actions of the elders of Gilead and their relationships with Jephthah. So I just thought I would bring that out. One other thing I'd like to bring out in Jephthah's connection is a clarification of what Jephthah meant when he got ready to fight the battle. And he was assaying his forces against the forces of the Ammonites and recognized that he couldn't win or rely on winning unless God, of course, provided assistance. That what is it that he promised God? In verse 30, Jephthah vowed a vow to the Eternal and said, if you shall without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that it should be whosoever comes forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Eternal's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Now, God punished him by causing his daughter to be the one to come out first. Why did God do that? You see, some people have speculated, well, he meant an animal. Well, what would have been wrong then with offering that? But in the clearest sense of the word, it was a human being that he meant. Remember, this Jephthah was not totally Israelite, and he had been reared, or rather grown up a lot in a non-Israelite area where human sacrifice was common. So he had a lot of wrong ideas. They weren't typical for an Israelite. But why is it that God chose to punish him? It wasn't just because he offered him a human being. What is it that was in this vow that God took great offense at? Usually that would be done by doing the sacrifice first, you see, and then binding God that way. There wasn't so much that, but there was something in the way, the content of the vow. Gary? Yeah, because you see, notice what he's saying. He says, if you'll do what I request, I'll give you an offering. You know, whatever servant comes out, I'll make him burn offering. In other words, I'll take any one of my lowly servants and I'll use that. In other words, what does God expect when one makes an offering? The best, you see. So it's not, besides the fact that he's involved in a very wrong practice, you see, it's also he wasn't even willing to offer the best. You see, both parts of that insult to God to understand why God punished him so severely. And I know different scholars have debated the issue endlessly in print as to whether he ever did offer his daughter or not. And I think the preponderance of evidence seems to indicate that he did fulfill that particular vow upon her urging. Remember, this was an age where Israel was not on track most of the time. And a lot of things went on then that would not have gone on in the days of the patriarchs or gone on in the days later in Israel under the righteous kings like David or Solomon or Hezekiah or Josiah. And this is another insight into this very disturbed period of time, a very chaotic period of time. Okay, let's now get into this matter of the Philistines, and to assist us in considering the Philistines and their relationships with Israel, I've prepared a chart. Remember, this material on the Philistines will not be on the test on Monday. It will appear on the third test. The only reason we're doing this today is so that you don't get the test today, but have a little more time to prepare. Considering the Philistines, we can divide their periods of ascendancy over Israel into five phases, or at least their attempts to exercise authority over Israel into five phases. And I've tried to associate the significant individuals, biblical personalities who are associated with the various phases, and to give you an idea of the major events that transpire during each phase. Now, the term Philistine itself, used as a literary expression, especially among English and American writers, is used as sort of a derogatory term. To call somebody a Philistine is equivalent to saying that they're rather uncouth, uncultured type of people. And this is rather unfortunate because the Philistines had a very high level of culture. Their pottery was the finest, was much finer than anything that had been produced locally in Canaan. Their other arts of civilization were of a very high order. And so it's an unfortunate usage to describe somebody as a Philistine, meaning that they're uncouth and uncultured. The Philistines are a very important people in terms of the history of Israel, because they represented the most serious military threat that Israel faced in the land of Canaan. Now, from within the land. I'm not talking about foreign oppressors like the Egyptians or the Babylonians or the Assyrians who came in from outside. I'm talking about from within the land itself. The strongest military threat that Israel ever faced came from the Philistines. In fact, for a time, if we had left God out of the picture, we just looked at the ebb and flow of Israelite-Philistine relations, and if you had been a commentator, a political commentator at the time, observing this relationship as it took place over several centuries, you would have been hard put to predict which of the two powers would have emerged as the victor. That it was sort of a nip-and-tuck type of struggle between the Philistines and Israel. And the price, of course, if the Israelites had lost, would probably have been the extinguishing of their not only independence, but of also possibly physically as a nation. And so it's obvious why God had to be a factor to prevent that from happening. The Philistines are also a very important figure in the biblical story, because it was the Philistine threat more than any other thing which created the Israelite demand for a monarchy. Because when the people asked Samuel for a king, they weren't just asking for a king, as we will see later, when we take up the transitional period in which Samuel fits. They were asking for a monarchy. Now you might say, what's the difference between asking for a king and asking for a monarchy? Well, why don't you weigh that between now and Wednesday, and see if you can figure out what the difference is between asking for a king and asking for a monarchy. Consider that the request came against the background of this very intensive and almost continuous military threat they faced from the Philistines. Now, the Philistines, their ultimate origins are a little bit obscure. We don't really know where exactly this people should be placed in terms of their origins. The Bible only mentions the place from which they sprang when they came to Canaan, which may be the place of their origins and may be only an intermediate point on their journey to Canaan. We don't know. The Bible very clearly tells us that they came from the island of Kaphtor, C-A-P-H, T-O-R, Kaphtor. And indeed, in other places, they are called Kerethites. Kerethites, which also is an allegation of this particular origin. Now, where in the world is Kaphtor? Based on other inscriptions, other documents from the Middle East, we feel that we should associate Kaphtor with the island of Crete. And it's interesting that the Philistines move into Canaan in extremely large numbers, although there's reason for believing that they were there earlier by small colonies, especially in the time of Abraham. They move in en masse around the year 1200 or shortly before. And it's interesting that on Crete, at about that period of time, the rich culture of Crete collapsed. just before the Philistines leave Crete and come into Canaan. And so there obviously is some sort of a connection between the collapse of the Minoan culture on Crete and the wanderings of the Philistines that eventually caused them to settle into Canaan. But the exact connection is obscure. We don't know if these are Cretans who then leave their native island and seek some other home, or if these were a subordinate subject people of the Cretans who were freed of their slavery, so to speak, by the collapse of that power and were then free to go elsewhere. We just are not all too clear on these points. One of the interesting things about the Philistines is that, of course, the question enters in, how could Abraham have had any relationships with Philistines? And some scholars are of the opinion that the mention of Abraham having a relationship with Abimelech, the Philistine king of the city of Gerar, where he palmed off again his wife as his sister, and Isaac having relationships with those Philistines, that that's an anachronism. The Philistines didn't exist in Canaan in that early period. However, even the great Albright admitted the following, that if we consider that the Philistines only arrived in Canaan around 1200 B.C., we have an example which is unprecedented in terms of rapid acculturation by the foreign group to their new home. In other words, what Albright observed is if one accepts the conventional view that there were no Philistines in Canaan until around 1200 B.C., by 1100, it is amazing, 100 years, or maybe less, they lose most of their unique Philistine attributes and become like the Canaanites. They adopt the Canaanite language. You ever wonder why Samson was able to talk to them very easily and be understood by them? You might not realize it, but even the riddle he gave, you know, with the honey and the lion, it's a play on words which is only applicable in Hebrew, which, of course, is a Canaanite dialect. How could they even have had a hope of understanding it? There would be no point to the riddle unless they were fluent with that language. And we know from other sources the Philistines did use the Canaanite dialect, which is, of course, almost the same as Hebrew. Their gods. Who is one of the chief gods of the Philistines? Dagon. But Dagon is not a Philistine god. Dagon is a Canaanite god. So they've even adopted one of the local gods as their own. You see, they have acculturated to Canaan quite to a very great extent, and they did it with extreme rapidity. And that's why Albright said there's no other precedent in history for a cultural group coming to a new land and so quickly dropping, you know, most of their old ways and picking up the new ways of their new land of residence. And, of course, I think the answer lies in the fact that these people were helped to acculturate. That the Philistines had had trading colonies in Canaan before who were acculturated. Now, how do we know that they were acculturated? Well, the Philistine king of Gerar, what is his name that Abraham dealt with? Abimelech. That is not a Philistine name. The captain of his host, who we read about in connection with Isaac, Pichol, that's not a Canaanite name. That's a Philistine name. But the king's name, Abimelech, is a good Canaanite name. So we have evidence that the Philistines that Abraham and Isaac had dealings with already were fairly acculturated to Canaan. And so therefore, when the main wave of Philistines came in, you can understand why they could quickly become acculturated, because they already had people of their ethnic group long resident in Canaan who were acculturated and could guide them and help them in this process. In the same way that many immigrant groups who have come to the United States and possibly also to Canada have been helped to acculturate to their new country by previous arrivals from their own group. who have set up formal or informal programs to help them become acculturated to their new homes. And this, of course, greatly speeds the process. Yes, Mr. Mason. We don't know why, whether they were the dominant power and when their power collapsed they needed to find a new home, or if they were more a subordinate race to the Cretans and held in some type of subjection on the main island, and when their Cretan power collapsed they were free to go elsewhere. And they chose to go to the location where some of their people had been placed. You see, the Cretans managed an enormous maritime commercial network in the eastern Mediterranean. And that would explain why they may have placed these colonies of Philistines not only in Canaan but elsewhere as well. And so they chose that particular location to go to. Okay, we'll pick up with these Philistines on Wednesday and finish the Philistines in connection with Samuel as well. And Monday, of course, we'll have our test.